Hello, and this time on Sit Rep, who is promising what on defence? How much is it driving the election campaign? And are there really any significant differences between the main players? NATO needs to learn the language of AI, according to a senior Royal Navy officer. How can we properly share and analyse data with our friends and allies? And the moment that made me.
We were shocked. We'd woken up at night and told you're going to war now. Get on with it. And everyone was caught slightly with their trousers down, quite frankly, because this wasn't on the menu at all.
Julian Thompson, who led 3 Commando Brigade in the Falklands conflict, is the first veteran to share their story of the most pivotal moment in their life and career for our new Sit Rep series.
Sit Rep.
With Kate Chabot and Professor Michael Clark.
And Mike, Julian's story there, it's a reminder. We really do need to expect the unexpected, don't we?
Yeah. And hearing Julian there, you know, I think about Major Mike Norman, who was the Royal Marine, who was on the Falklands on the 1st of April, in charge of 57 Marines who were going to be overwhelmed by the invasion they know was going to take place. And he got them together and he said to them, "We're going to die tonight." And he said, "Now go away. Think about your wives, your girlfriends, your dog, whatever matters to you. Think about it. Do them credit and then close that book and then we'll do the job. And remember, we're not doing this for the country. We're doing this for the Royal Marines." And that was that's a moment that most of us don't have to live through, but that shapes everybody's life. And talking to some of the Marines afterwards who did survive, who were captured rather than killed, they said that you can't ever have a normal life after you've had a moment where your commander says, "We're going to die tonight, go away and think about it, and then come back and do your job."
This is a sobering thought, isn't it? Well, we'll hear much more from Julian later. But first, the big job of the day is the general election. The promises from the biggest parties are all published now. And SitRep's James Hurst has been leafing through the manifestos for us. James, how'd you get on? Give us the overview. What characterises the manifestos in this election then?
So, well, let me just give you some context first. We're going to go through the sort of main parties with most electoral support in Great Britain. So, England, Scotland and Wales. If you look at the Conservatives, Labour, Liberal Democrats, Reform UK, they've all got substantial defence sections. A bit on defence, but not so much from Plaid Cymru, the Greens and the SNP. So we'll come to them in a bit. There is, in a sense, there's a lot of similarity between the parties. There's not a huge amount of big ideas. There are some standouts there. I don't think there are any great surprises. There's a lot of status quo. The thing that, for me, characterises this set of manifestos is those parties are all giving their own version of saying they want to spend 2.5% of national income on defence. Now, if you might remember this, you go back to 2015, not one major party would even commit to continuing to meet that NATO threshold. So the ground has shifted. And I think if anything characterises not so much these manifestos, but this election, it's that.
Yes, I think that's right. And these are very predictable manifestos, but the one that is of most interest, of course, is the Labour manifesto, because that overwhelmingly is the one that is likely to be part of a governing party. And what the Labour Party have said in the manifesto, I think that, you know, there is some interest there, because the idea of creating a military strategic headquarters, which, in other words, to extend the role of PJHQ to something that's more politico-military, not just military, and to have they always say they'll have a review, but they're privately saying that the review will take a year, but there'll be a sprint review inside that. In other words, they'll come up with a very quick overview within a couple of months and then a longer term review over the next few months after that. And then the Labour Party have said, we will have an EU security treaty, a British EU or UK EU security treaty, and a bilateral deal, we hope, with Germany. So there's some substance there, which does show a different emphasis that a Labour government will put on defence compared to what the other parties are saying, which is more of the same and we'll afford more as and when we can, is really what they're all saying.
And James, just to go drill down a little bit more into the spending and the size of the armed force, can you give us the detail on the spending?
Yeah, so let me compare and contrast party by party. The Conservatives, as Rishi Sunak announced some time ago, but it's written in their manifesto, they say they will boost defence spending to 2.5% of GDP by 2030. So they're setting a date. Interestingly, they say they call that our new NATO standard. So they're also promising to campaign for that within NATO. The money they've said will come from reducing civil service headcount. And they're saying they'd spend the money on boosting the defence industrial base, accelerating modernisation, investing in technology, and also funding an army in Ukraine. Now, as Mike mentioned, Labour's policy is for a strategic defence review within their first year in government. And they say they will set out the path to spending 2.5% of GDP on defence. So the big difference there is whether or not you set a date. The Lib Dems say they will increase defence spending in every year of the Parliament, an ambition, same as Labour, to spend at least 2.5% on defence. But Lib Dems go specific on the size of the armed forces, which neither Labour nor the Conservatives do. So they say they would reverse the Conservative government's cut to the army, so a little under 10,000 in the last defence review. And they've got an ambition. And again, it's an ambition, not a commitment, to get regular troop numbers back up to 100,000. The really ambitious one in this is Reform UK. Say they would reach 2.5% of GDP within 3 years, and then 3% within 6 years. And they're saying they would recruit 30,000 extra for the army.
And Mike, when you look at those differences in ambitions laid out there by James, how big are they, do you think?
I think they're all starting points, because I think we all accept that in the next few years we're probably going to spend a fair bit more on defence. I mean, how that will be paid for is a different question. But I think going into an election, nobody wants to look as if they're making unfunded commitments. In a campaign, nobody's going to be that sort of aggressive over defence, because it sounds like a very big commitment to spend a lot of money quite soon.
And James, can you just walk us through now the signature policies by the main parties?
Yeah, so these are the ones that stand out as different. If you look at, say, the Lib Dems, they're promising closer cooperation with EU agencies and member states over defence. Mike mentioned Labour have said they will seek an ambitious new EU-UK security pact. So there's some similarity there. Lib Dems, I mean, this is a long-running one for them. So they would legislate to ensure a parliamentary vote on military action. Reform UK, I mean, the only one I could see that really stood out that I couldn't see anywhere else is free education for military personnel. And we'll talk a bit more about personnel and veterans in a minute. We know the Conservative signature policy in terms of defence national service. It spells out the detail, year-long full-time placement. They talk a bit about the funding. But it is that, it's what Mike said. It feels like the Labour manifesto to me as well is the only one that's talked when they talk about this new military strategic HQ inside the Ministry of Defence. So eventually they're saying that, you know, PGHQ is fine for managing current operations. This is a new one to deal with strategic direction. That feels really like the only big strategic offer, new offer from any of the parties. The other one that's raised some interest is the fact they're saying they would create a new National Armaments Director. Now, that might come as a shock to the current National Armaments Director. We've spoken to him on sit rep before, but he's also the head of DE&S, Defence Equipment and Support. So this would be a single role, and essentially National Armaments Director will direct what needs to be done on procurement. DE&S will deliver it. The Conservatives are doubling down on the changes they say they've already made, their new integrated procurement model. So they say, look, we're already in the process of making procurement faster and more joined up.
And Mike, apart from the things that you've already outlined, is there anything else that stands out to you?
Only that there's no disagreement on retaining the nuclear deterrent, which is interesting, because usually, I mean, in the past, of course, that there has been a Labour difference, a Labour Conservative difference on that, and Lib Dem difference. And the only parties that are committed to getting rid of the deterrent are the Nationalist Party, so Plaid Cymru, the SNP. They have a non-nuclear policy, but the alignment on nuclear issues and the lack of any discussion in the manifestos on the nuclear issue is different this time, I think, compared to previous times.
Yeah, and that's a good point, actually, to bring in here SNP, Plaid Cymru and the Greens, because as Mike says, the thing that joins them together is their opposition to Trident. Mm. The SNP's only defence policy seems to be scrapping Trident. They would scrap Trident. One standout from Plaid Cymru, they say they oppose increased defence spending. The Greens are kind of nuanced on NATO. They support NATO, but they say they want reform, that it must act solely in defence of member states. So, but you know, they've not got full defence sections like Conservatives, Labour, Lib Dems, Reform.
So let's talk about the people and the veterans, because that's what our listeners will be very interested in. What kind of pledges are we hearing?
I mean, again, there's nothing big groundbreaking there, but they're all promising a bit more. So Conservatives, a first ever veterans bill to enshrine veterans' rights in law. They say they'll improve service family accommodation. No more detail on that. Labour say they would put the Armed Forces Covenant fully into law. Lib Dems say the Armed Forces Covenant will be strengthened by placing a legal duty on the Defence Secretary and government departments to give it due regard, again, improving the standard of Ministry of Defence to housing. Again, Reform UK offering something more ambitious, a dedicated ministerial veterans department. That's tweaking with the app in. But for serving personnel, they say in their first 100 days, an urgent pay review to increase basic pay across the armed forces. They say the reason for that, boosting recruitment and retention.
So Mike, pretty much apart from that, sort of status quo on this.
Yes, I mean, I think all the parties commit themselves to, you know, rededicating the importance of personnel in defence, and there's nothing new here that we don't see in most manifestos. And the issue always is, well, whoever becomes the government, are they really going to do it? Will they really put the money into it, and will they engage in proper long-term investment? They always say they're going to, and it sort of runs out of steam quite quickly, usually, but we'll see.
So the big question, how much does defence matter to voters?
So I was looking at the latest polling data I could find was from Ipsos at the start of the week. Defence is down, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, I think, in the list. 12% of respondents put it in their sort of most important issues. You know, you look at the NHS, top of the list, 41%, economy, 33%, immigration, 30%. It's up there a bit, but I'm not sure how much that says it's cutting through. I don't know what you think, Mike.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, it's higher than it usually is at 7th. It's normally down in 9th, 10th, 11th place in terms of priority. So it's gone up the priority list a bit. And the people who say it's important is a little bit higher than normal. But nobody's ever going to fight a whole election on defence. And it's part of a package of a sense of, you know, are we happy with more of the same, or do we want a different approach? I mean, this election is much more about gut feelings than policy areas. So I don't read too much into that lower rating for defence. It's inevitable, really. And I think I can't think of any time when defence was really featured in an election, even in 1983, when it was a big nuclear issue between a non-nuclear Labour Party and a Thatcher government just on the back of the Falklands. Even that election was really dominated by an instinctive swing of the pendulum rather than particular policy areas.
And it just bears saying, doesn't it? I know this is going to come as a surprise to nobody, that you know, ultimately, you know, a lot of people in the armed forces are going to be making their mind up on a list exactly the same way. You know, they use hospitals, they use schools, they have families. Mm-hmm. So it makes sense that even though it is higher up the political agenda and higher up people's agenda, it's not going to push to the top. You know, everybody ultimately cares about the big picture of how this is going to make their life work better.
And before we move on, anything we missed?
Nope.
Shaking heads all round. James, thanks very much. I'll let you, with your other hat on, go and finish editing this episode, because you're also the editor of SITREP. Thanks very much. Busy James, he is a very busy guy. Now, Britain's armed forces are already quite some way down a very long road of digital transformation. We talked before about how new kit packed with sensors is providing ever more data that could give a battle-winning advantage, but only if you can share and make sense of that data, find the needle in the haystack, as it were. Well, AI has the potential to be a huge help, but a senior officer leading some of the UK's military technology strategy says we also need to get better at sharing both the data and AI to process it with allies and partners. The Royal Navy's Director Develop, Rear Admiral James Parkin, was giving a keynote speech at the Surface Air and Seabed Warfare Conference in Portsmouth. Well, SITREP's Tom Sables was there. Hi, Tom. Tell us a bit more about what he had to say then.
Hi there, Kate. So the key message from Admiral Parkin was there needs to be a shift in perspective on artificial intelligence, algorithms, and defense data more generally. So as we move further down that line, it's viewed in the same way we look at, say, standard NATO rounds or common refueling methods. Crucially, though, this would rely heavily on sharing data that actually belongs to industry in the UK and elsewhere to really get all of the nation's systems singing from the same hymn sheet. And there's been calls for more combat data, actually. So allies could use something that builds an estimate of what they need more of after the first week or so of combat. And that operates on the idea that lines of communication to ask for things won't be as good during conflict itself. And they could even be targeted, those lines of communication. I learned adversaries like China perhaps have a data advantage here because a lot of the industry is government owned. So, of course, a lot of the type of information we're talking about is readily available to the military anyway, hence the calls for the UK forces to get a move on with implementing AI, like we heard from the Second Sea Lord a few weeks back, but now also to make sure we're not adding another language barrier to our alliances in doing so.
And Tom, it is a big ask. A lot of potential allies using different kits. How do we do it?
Well, that's the big question. And luckily for me, the chairman of the conference happened to be retired Rear Admiral Alex Burton, so former commander UK Maritime Forces. I actually ambushed him in the breakout coffee room and he gave us a few of his insights as well.
What we've got to be able to do is to start producing conduits that enable data to be selectively shared between industries, between industry and militaries, between militaries of various countries at a far greater scale than we do. Now, the prize at the end of this is if we can get the diversity of data and the diversity of sensors that the Western alliances have, then we'll be at a significant advantage over China and our other adversaries.
What stands out to you as a challenge of AI in terms of it being another language that NATO needs to learn and have in common?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I think I've broadened it beyond NATO to allies of choice, wherever those allies and those adversaries might be. So in the instance of the Euro-Atlantic, of course, that's most likely to be NATO. It could be the JEF, which is a subcomponent of NATO now. It could be a French-UK operation. But out in the Far East, in the Pacific, you're talking about AUKUS, the Australians, the Americans, potentially the Japanese, potentially the South Koreans as well. So at the heart of it is how, as navies, as joint forces, we're able to interoperate, integrate, and potentially interchange our capabilities together to give that decision advantage. I think the key issue is if you really want to get advantage in insight, in intelligence, in information, then the AI algorithms will need to be shared more broadly. But most particularly, data will need to be shared between friends, between allies, at a volume and at a pace that is far greater than we've seen previously. We won't be able to share all our data with everyone, so selectively share data between partners and share it fast and be agile to change those sharing agreements.
So a key point there at the end is actually the agility in changing data sharing agreements. Of course, data protection is hugely vital, but also hugely complex. Admiral Burton also touched on the ethical discretion or the lack of adversaries would build into their AI models and the drone that could be at the steering wheel of drones in the future. So if we're, you know, if that's what we're up against, then taking advantage of alliance members was deemed crucial, or being an alliance member would be crucial.
Mike, there are a couple of challenges here. The technical ones stand out, but the policy challenges of who you share what information with and how you might need to adapt that at any given moment.
Yes. I mean, Admiral Merton was speaking there about, you know, sharing with allies and how much you share and so on. And I'd offer one really simple but very important example, very basic. I mean, what he's talking about sounds very abstract and quite hard to grasp. But there's a very specific issue. I mean, Turkey has purchased S-400 Russian air defense systems. Now, they haven't operated them. They haven't started to operate them. And what NATO is saying to Turkey is, if you operate S-400s, then our F-35s in the Eastern Mediterranean are linked in to the system that you're operating because it's an integrated system. And that means that our F-35's material goes straight back to Moscow. Don't tell us that your S-400s are insulated from Moscow. Of course they're not. So if you operate these systems, we will exclude you from the air defense role within NATO, because we've got to protect all the information on our F-35s flying in the Eastern Mediterranean. Now, that's a very simple, rather important example of the problems of data sharing in a very complex world. And that is even within NATO, let alone within countries in Asia or our partners elsewhere in the world. So it's a really big problem. I mean, if we can get it right, there's a tremendous battlefield advantage there. But if you get it wrong, you end up giving away an awful lot of very important material to potential adversaries.
And Tom, just going back to Rear Admiral Parkin's speech, his message was pitched to a room where there were a lot of senior military officers from around the world.
That's right, yeah, Portuguese, Chilean. I'd actually be really interested to know if over the next coming years, as this becomes more and more of a pressing issue, we see the subtle or not so subtle prompts to develop that data sharing capability from allies who perhaps have militaries that aren't so advanced, so they can't collect their own data on the scale that would be required for them to meet their defense objectives. And for me, I think that will really almost maybe put alliances in a difficult position, where we have one or two key partners perhaps doing a lot of the workload when it comes to data, as we move towards a data-driven battle space. And sharing as much of it as is required by maybe partners who can't collect as much of their own.
Tom, really fascinating stuff. Thanks so much. Tom Sables there. Well, let's finish by going back to an era where data intelligence were mostly written down on paper. For the first in our new series, The Moment That Made Me, sharing veteran stories about how their military career has shaped their life, we're recalling a time before mobile phones. It's the very early hours of the 2nd of April, 1982. For Major General Julian Thompson, this was the moment that made him.
I was commanding the 3rd Commander Brigade. My rank was Brigadier. It was the second year of my command. And I just got back from Denmark, where we'd been wrecking an exercise. And when I got back, my staff said, hey, there's been a bit of a problem as far as the landing, which isn't going to involve us. I thought, all right, let's go to bed. So I went to bed and woke up at 1 o'clock in the morning by my boss, Jeremy Moore, saying, you know those people down south, they're about to be invaded. Bring your brigade to short notice and sail on Tuesday. This was Friday. So a bit of a tall order. That really made me, because it was a shock to be woken up at night and told you're going to war now. Get on with it.
And what were your initial feelings and thoughts when you got this news?
Well, my initial feelings, I say, were horror. We were totally unprepared. And also horror that my staff weren't there. Actually, they turned up at about tea time on the first day, having blagged their way onto various aeroplanes and things like that. And then we really got down to it and started buzzing. And we sailed, this was Friday, we sailed on Tuesday.
Can you remember the moment you went to bed? And you heard there'd been some trouble in the South Atlantic, but you obviously weren't really kind of taking it that seriously in terms of your involvement. But how did you go to bed that night?
Well, I went to bed that night thinking I was going to go and have a big conference the next day, which is why I'd come back from Denmark with a whole lot of people who were going to talk about our exercise program. Of course, that all went out of the window. And the trouble was, actually, the reason I discovered was that we didn't know was though the Navy were getting ready, they'd forgotten to tell the Royal Marines, which is rather silly when part of the game was to take back the islands. How are they going to take it back without the Royal Marines? I have no idea. Anyway, that was their problem. And it was also our problem, because we had to get a hustle on the next day.
It's early hours of the morning. So how much notice did you have? Was it the next day you had to deploy?
This is 2 o'clock in the morning, okay, on the second. Actually, they hadn't invaded at that stage. They were about to invade. They because of the timings being later west of us, they didn't start invading until about 2 or 3 hours after I was woken up. Now, what had happened? So the Navy had got the buzz because the first Sea Lord, Henry Leach, had been looking at signals a day or two earlier and had realised that the Argies were about to invade. And he went down to the House of Commons to beard the Secretary of State for Defence, and he was ushered into Maggie Thatcher. And he went in to overhear the Secretary of State and the Foreign Office saying, if they invade, there's nothing we can do about it. And he chipped in and said, yes, there is. And she said, what? So he said, prepare a task force, give me the authority. Well, a task force would be useless without the Marines. Unfortunately, they forgot to tell us for some reason.
How could they forget to tell you?
Well, I don't know. I don't know how they forget. It was just bad staff work, I suspect. And everyone was caught slightly with their trousers down, quite frankly, because this wasn't on the menu at all. War in the South Atlantic wasn't part of the game. There were no contingency plans whatsoever, because the MOD had done a study about 6 months earlier, which came up with the conclusion that if the Argies invaded, there was nothing we could do about it. So if this is going to be mission impossible, there's no point in making a plan. So the box marked mission impossible was opened, and we were told to get on with it. That was it. And of course, the first thing we had to find was, how are you going to get there? By sea. Okay. So you need ships. Then we had a thing called the Red Book, which told us exactly what ships were suitable. But of course, in the Red Book, it said whatever it was. And the Red Book was absolutely useless because the ship you wanted was off Panama or somewhere like that, or in the middle of the Pacific. So you just had to take whatever was available. And whatever was available was the nearest ship. And you just said, sail it to Bristol. Where's the nearest depot, wherever it was, tipping all the stuff in their stores. 17,000 tons of ammunition in the stores we had to take down. So it was a hell of a lot to do. Luckily, the RSC, or rather RCT Transport, TA, laid an absolute blinder. They mobilized all their truck drivers. So there were literally hundreds of trucks rushing around the country delivering stores to the various ports. And I was then standing, this was on a Tuesday, I think, on the helipad at Plymouth Stonehouse, where I was based, and with one or two people ready to fly out to the ships that were out in Lyme Bay. It was very foggy. Helicopters clattered in out of the mist. We climbed in, went away, and then we eventually saw the welcome sight through the fog of the wake of Fearless, the ship we were going to join. We joined her, plonked down on the deck, and there we were.
At that point, did you feel prepared? Were you ready?
Well, I was ready as I could be. I mean, we were very silent that first day, sort of sitting and eating our meal, thinking, what the hell are we doing now? Just getting ready. And it all started coming together, because actually the brigade I commanded was a jolly good brigade with a super staff. They were ready for just these sort of things. I didn't really have to worry in the end. In the end, it became just routine.
It's interesting that you chose, of all the things that happened before, during, and at the moment the Argentinians actually surrendered during the conflict, that the moment that you chose was the phone call. It wasn't the battle for Goose Green. It wasn't the battle for Mount Tumbledown. It wasn't the moment that they capitulated in Stanley. Why that particular moment, the phone call? Why is that the moment that made you?
Well, it's such a wake-up call. I mean, you don't normally get a call to war from your bed. The middle of the night. It's a fairly unusual thing to happen. There's no warning at all, nothing. You just go to war, bonk, like that. It just, and that sort of jolted me into reality, I think. That's why I chose that moment.
Do you, when you rewind and think about that night or the early hours when you got that phone call, the way you reacted, have you got any lessons that you can share with us in how to rise to the occasion when you get that kind of thing?
Well, I think the lesson is to have a good team. But my goodness me, I had a good team. And I wouldn't be able to do it by myself. There's absolutely no doubt about that. And the lesson is that it's James Hill's lessons. Gentleman Jordan is made of chaos reigns. Chaos undoubtedly will reign. It did. And I remember my company commanders, I had some very experienced company commanders who'd fought in the Dofar War. they said to their companies, be disappointed if chaos doesn't reign, because it did. You've got to work through it. And the guy who wins is the guy who sorts out the chaos quicker than the other guy.
Do you miss the chaos?
No.
Major General Julian Thompson, fab to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Kate, lovely to talk to you too.
And each week on SITREP over the summer, we will hear from more veterans, all answering the same question. What is the moment that made you? Mike, that is incredible what Julian Thompson said there, that the Navy hadn't told the Marines about the deployment of this task force.
Yes, I mean, that's what happens in crises. People forget the most obvious things. Even you look at the Cuba crisis, the most dramatic crisis in modern history, the number of things that were forgotten to do, that people forgot to do or didn't think about, is legion. You can make a whole list of them. It does tend to happen. Some of the most basic things get forgotten when everybody comes together. I mean, you know, crises are a pressure of time, threat, and surprise. You know, time is telescoped, there's a threat of something, and everyone is surprised. And that time, threat, and surprise combination creates lots and lots of mistakes. And the side that, as Julian was saying there, really, the side that prevails is usually the one that makes the fewest mistakes.
And that chaos that Julian spoke about, they pulled it out the bag. Are we now underestimating what we could pull out the bag if we needed to?
We do underestimate in a way, because we always rely on our armed forces to perform miracles of improvisation. But the things that Julian said there were really important. First of all, the staff has got to be good. You've got to have a good staff. And I hear that again and again from military leaders. There has to be, I mean, Eisenhower said plans are rubbish, but planning is everything. No plan is any good, but you've got to be able to plan quickly for the situation. So plans are rubbish in themselves, but planning is everything, and you need a good staff to do that. And the other thing he said is stores and ammunition. The ability to get, did you say 17,000 tons of stores and ammunition, you know, to the South Coast quickly, stores and ammunition. And that's the issue that we face now, is that, you know, if we, our forces can be as inventive and brave as you like, if they run out of ammunition and equipment, doesn't matter how brave they are, they're going to lose.
And there we must leave it this time, Mike. Thanks so much. And my thanks to all of our guests. That is it for now. Professor Michael Clark and I will be back with another SITREP next Thursday. Until then, you can always catch up with past programmes you might have missed online at bfbs.com/SITREP, the Forces News YouTube channel, or wherever you get your podcasts. For now, though, from me, Kate Chabot, thank you for listening. Bye for now.